Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes and another afternoon Zero Point radio show. I welcome past listeners and anyone who is going to take part for the first time in Zero Point discussions. In the background there, I have James Moffat. Jim, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay, so I hope we don't have trouble with the connection today.
Yeah.
As you suggested we might, but if we do, you or I could keep it here.
Yeah, we've had a few technical difficulties, and are you getting an echo at all? I was getting a bit of an echo from you, but now I'm not.
Oh, good. Okay. I'm getting a little bit of a buzz, but that's okay. Okay. Anyone out there in the audience who might like to call in, I'm going to give the numbers out, and Jim and I are going to take the show for the first hour, and then we'll open it up at halfway through.
Hello,
and,
Chris?
Yes?
I just wanted to say that we are using, that's why I asked you if you were using a digital line, because we are using digital lines. Now, we can switch over, but it is going to be clearer. The clarity will be clear, but if it does cut in and out, just pause for a second, repeat what you're going to say. If you find that these digital lines are no good for you, next show, you just say, I want to use the regular lines, but it's going to be now a choice. Okay?
I'm sorry, I can't quite differentiate what you're saying.
Okay. I'll say it again. We're using digital lines. Digital lines.
So you're using digital lines.
Correct. They might cut in and out. If they do, just pause and then repeat what you're going to say. Now, next week, you can have your choice if you wish to use digital or regular AT&T lines. It will be up to you. But just keep an eye on this show and tell me how it goes. And if you want to continue with the digital, let's do so. It is clear, but it may cut in and out. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. So are we on air at the moment?
Yes, we are definitely on air.
Okay. Okay. So we're just continuing on. Okay. Thanks, Don. Okay. So, I'll give those numbers out. I'll give them out on the hour halfway through the show. And if anyone would like to call in, then they can have a pen ready and take the number at that time. Okay, so my website's at www.zeropoint.ca. Zero Point spelled out in letters. And up there I have quite a wealth of material. Chapters from all six of the books I've published on Zero Point Studies and on Blavatsky and two books on Gurdjieff. Quite a variety of fairly scholarly books. In my work, I see my purpose a bit as a psychologist and scientist is that I've investigated mystical esoteric traditions, trying to understand those in the context of my knowledge of modern psychology and modern science. And what I've arrived at is really a highly unique kind of synthesis of certain key elements in the ancient wisdom teachings. And I'm trying to explain now how those might be related to concepts in modern science, particularly concepts in modern physics. Now, the key area of our investigations are the study of consciousness, the science of the soul, and the nature of self, and the key concepts that I'm elaborating has to do firstly with what I call the heart doctrine, that an individual's true essential self, or I, is associated with the heart center, which is associated with the physical heart, but it's also a spiritual heart center. That all beings in the way have a spiritual heart related to the physical heart. The heart in the way is a playground of higher and lower forces. So we're trying to explore the psychology of self and the heart and of consciousness. And I'm trying to explain an alternate model of the nature of human existence. So I'm going to try to elaborate that fairly succinctly and give a talk a little bit on that for 20 minutes or half an hour. As I point out repeatedly in my writing, the whole of Western psychology and science has assumed the head doctrine, that consciousness is produced somehow within the head, by the brain. So the mind and consciousness are seen as centered in the head, and I call this the head doctrine. And even in modern science, they think the emotional centers are really up in the head, in the limbic system, in the midbrain structure. They don't regard, in modern times, there's no psychology of the heart. Although people all the time talk about the heart and associate it with love and feeling and the essence of things, in psychology, no one considers that you could really experience things in your heart. How could you do that? Isn't it all just in the mind, in the head, where the consciousness is? And modern scientists also think there is no essential I in the person. Like if you think of that word I in writer, it's singular. So there is no like singular I in the individual. So although we say I all the time, it's really, they would argue, an illusion that there is no constancy of I or central I. And when scientists imagine there being a central I, the kind of I they imagine is a little man up in the head watching what goes on in the brain in the head. That's the kind of little I they might imagine. One prominent scientist, Francis Crick, had a book called The Astonishing Hypothesis. And although it sounds astonishing, when you read the book, The Astonishing Hypothesis is that a human being doesn't really have to have a spirit or soul, but instead, all we are, in Crick's terms, is a, quote, pack of neurons. So we're just an assembly of all these neurons, which are made into neural nets, and somehow these generate electricity, and that's kind of what we are. So we're nothing but a bunch of neurons. And when those neurons die, there is nothing in an individual that could persist beyond death. As Roger Sperry, a prominent Western scientist, say, he says, I see no way for consciousness existing apart from the functioning brain. And most scientists today agree with that. That's why psychology, for over a century, has completely ignored the study of spirit or soul and even of human consciousness. Okay, so what I explained then, I contrast the heart doctrine, which I argue, or I demonstrate, is evident in yogic Vedic teachings, Sufism, Kabbalah and esoteric Judaism, Christianity, Madame Blavatsky's secret doctrine, and other sources. It's in the Dalai Lama's Tibetan Buddhist teaching. And in this view, the heart doctrine view, it argues that the origins of consciousness and self is related to the human heart. And the heart is not simply a physical organ, but in a way, metaphysical or higher dimensional forces act through the heart. In a way, a person is ensouled through the heart. And in my work, I try to take what mystics have said about the nature of the self within the heart, and I try to understand those concepts, drawing upon concepts in modern physics. So a first point made by the mystics about the nature of the heart concerns the idea that the heart is regarded, for instance, in the Bhagavad Gita, which is the cream of the Vedas, like the essence of the Vedic teachings, yogic teachings about the nature of the self or the nature of the soul. And Lord Krishna says, I am the self seated in the hearts of all living beings. And it's explained in the Gita that there is both the Paramatma, which is the infinite soul, and the Jiva Atma, which is the infinitesimal spiritual soul, individual spirit soul. And they're both associated with the heart. And in a way, that jiva atma, you see, that is what I mean by there being an individual I. Something that's at some level of differentiation is singular. So the idea is there's a jiva atma, an infinitesimal point source, I would argue, of supernal light. Okay, it's like a spiritual spark. It's a consciousness principle and the life principle within the human being. It's this kind of spiritual spark associated with the spiritual heart, which underlies physical heart. In a way, I would argue that there's really four dimensions to the human heart, because there's four dimensions to everything in creation. And those levels in Kabbalah, they are referred to as the world of emanation, creation, the world of formation, and the world made. So I would argue that within the human heart, the highest level is a divine source emanation, this kind of jiva atma, or a monadic essence. Different terms are used in different systems. A divine spark, it's called in Sufism. Okay, so there's first the heart has this level of divine emanation, and it's not in the heart so much, because the heart is kind of a material thing in four-dimensional space-time. The divine source emanation is established in higher-dimensional space that underlies the material organ of the heart. Okay, so that divine world of emanation, and then the second world is the spiritual world. The spiritual world is, the divine realm is eternal. So the first realm of creation is the spiritual world. And so this divine source emanation is brought down and embodied in the spiritual self, also which we might think of as I would describe the divine source emanation as a zero-point condition, meaning a point so small that it kind of disappears from view, like a singularity. And then from that, I would describe the spiritual self as something the size of a small grape. That we go from the singularity point to something the size of a small grape of unemergent light. This is referred to in the mystical literature as the bliss sheath. Now, what I'm trying to explain here, it's similar to how modern scientists describe the origin of the universe. In the beginning, they describe the quantum vacuum. And then there's a point source of emergence from a singularity condition. And there is what they call a sudden inflationary era, where that point expands into something the size of a grapefruit, one scientist described it. So it expands exponentially, like very rapidly in the first instance of creation. And from a point source, we have what Blavatsky would call the dropping of the world egg. Okay, so from a point to the dropping of the world egg. Well, I would say similarly, a human being has a zero-point source, and then there's the dropping of the world egg, which is this causal body, this mass of unemergent light. And so that's in the higher spiritual level of the human heart. Then the third world of formation is the realm of the psyche and souling influences that underlie the material heart. So I would say we have a psychical heart. So, for instance, if someone had a heart transplant and received someone else's heart, in acquiring that heart, they might feel some of the emotional and psychical elements associated with the previous heart's owner. Okay, so that there's a level in the heart that has like psychical memory of emotions and emotional experiences through your life. That's the level of the psychical heart. And then the final level, you have the physical heart. So in the views I'm presenting, I'm saying there is actually a higher dimensional physics to what the human heart is. And so to understand the heart, we have to understand the nature of reality. we as beings exist within space, and we exist within zero-point fields. The more scientists, whereas the more scientists have studied the nature of space in modern times, they come to a very unusual understanding of the nature of reality. Because the more you look at the nature of space on a lower level of differentiation, as you go into the quantum vacuum, in a sense, there, instead of being empty and nothing, the more you go into the nature of space itself, the more it becomes the plenum, or the fullness of all things, full of infinite energy, or infinite intelligence, or infinite potency. And what we see manifest to our senses is the finite realm is just illusory and impermanent relative to this vast sea of information and energy and potency that underlies and sustains all things from within without. So I'm suggesting then that I'm trying to explain an alternate model of what human beings are. Instead of simply being material biological organisms with a brain that produces consciousness in the head, I'm saying that's all rubbish. That's the dogmas and pseudoscience. It's presented as science, but it's pseudoscience. It's based on misconceptions, false assumptions, wrong kind of reasoning. It's based on a lack of effort to study consciousness within oneself. From a mystical perspective, we have to study consciousness within ourselves by becoming conscious of our consciousness, in a sense, and making an effort to wake up and to be more fully conscious. And if you do this and begin to cultivate awareness of yourself, you realize that, of course, all your consciousness is not simply up in your head. Never was. It's an imaginary idea. These people are speaking off the top of their heads. They're cognitive scientists, so they confuse cognition with consciousness. But consciousness is something much deeper than just thinking or feeling or sensing. Consciousness is more like light. So in mystical and esoteric teachings, they identify the nature of the self or of the I. They identify it with light, and they associate it with the heart, and they see somehow a human being is ensouled through the heart. And I argue that the circulation of consciousness in the body is actually even related to the blood. The consciousness and vitality in the body circulate through the blood and through the breath. Mystical teachings suggest that we are ensouled through the breath. We might imagine the element of air added to the element of fire, of the spiritual spark. So the element air gives it like oxygen, so that it generates life. Okay, so somehow I'm saying there is a ghost in the machine, but it's not a ghost. It's not some kind of etheric mass of kind of etheric energies that's ghostly. But I'm saying, I mean, there is that too. There can be ghosts and ghostly shells, but I'm saying there is something far deeper in the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. Now, a couple ideas about the heart. Firstly, and how do we understand the nature of self and the nature of consciousness? And these are incredibly complex and subtle ideas, and these are the kinds of questions we try to understand through our lives and through many lives. And I don't want to pretend I know all the answers, because I know I don't, but this is a highly original concept of what we are, that we have this jiva atma within the higher dimensions of the heart, and it's a source of inner illumination, the light of the self. And that's why a human being can function as a holographic system, because there is, when you use holographic technology to create a hologram, you have a point source of laser light, Okay, and that laser light, part of it reflects off an object and onto a plate, and part of it goes directly onto the plate. It's called an object beam and a referent beam. And it's the interaction of these two beams that gives you a hologram. So I'm saying within the human being, there is a point source of laser light, supernal light. And that's the basis upon which we have our inner experience, how it's created holographically. So I'm also elaborating, Madame Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine, she says, material points without extension are the materials by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. Now, this is a very subtle and complicated quote. So she's saying, it's like there's a zero point, she's saying, is the basis upon which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. So when I sit here, I have a piece of paper in front of me, and I do a little circle in the center. That's kind of the zero point. And then you might draw some circles around that. So you might imagine that circle being embodied. You might draw seven circles around it, or however many. So the idea would be at the center of ourselves is the zero point center. But then surrounding that center form different bodies so that we are embodied into different dimensions. How do these bodies form? Well, I would argue that it's the matter is that this little element, this jiva atma, exists in the higher dimensional space. It actually exists in seven dimensional hyperspace. And this little element has certain spin properties. It's a very complex inner structure to it. In physics, it's similar to what physicists call Calabi-Yau spaces, which are seven-dimensional complex little elements that exist, they say, at every point in space-time is a seven-dimensional Calabi-Yau space. So I'm saying a human being has one of these little elements established in higher dimensional space. And this little Calabi-Yau space, or monadic essence, it's in a way, it's like an element of light or of rays which kind of wind around and within each other. And that element has certain spin properties. And that the spin properties of that helps to create, out of the surrounding quantum vacuum, it breaks the symmetries in space surrounding it, so that material elements are crystallized out of or emerge out of the quantum vacuum. So because of the spin properties of the monadic essence, it forms a body around itself. And it does this on a succession of higher of planes of existence. So one might, first we're embodied within the spiritual realm and then psychical or astral body, and then in the material realm. So you might imagine if you look at your picture, you have a circle in the center. Say you put three rings around it. In a way, I would say a mental body, an astral body, and a physical body. And you have these three rings around a central point. Okay, if you have this diagram, imagine then that you erase the physical body. So you take out that outermost ring in your diagram. Well, what you see then is, well, although you take away the physical body, the outermost ring, the zero point is still embodied in the mental body and the astral body, in these higher bodies. Now, this is, see, it's very interesting, some of the evidences for near-death experiences. And what struck me about the study of those experiences, and also from having out-of-body experiences myself, is that when people report being out of their bodies, they report still being conscious, still maintaining some sense of personal identity, still being capable of thinking and still having emotions and feelings. They also have memory of who they are. They don't, all their memories not wiped away. So when people are out of their body, for the most part, they feel almost completely themselves. Now, this observation shows that really, even when we're in the physical body, it never was simply the physical body producing the consciousness and the experience of thoughts and emotions. No, it was the, it's more that the thinking, feeling, willing, living entity is inhabiting the body. And the body is only the lowest level of the inner man, the inner human being. Okay, so the idea then is that there's an actual science to this somehow, that there's a monadic essence in the higher dimensions of the heart, the idea that it's embodied in the bliss sheath, the size of a small grape. It's said if your consciousness resides in that bliss sheath, then you experience a state of samadhi. And the closer you get to that experience of the bliss sheath, that is the experience of self-realization. And the closer, it's like the self within the heart is obscured. Rumi compares it to a mirror. And on this mirror, it's all fogged up. It's fogged up so much that the mirror of the heart doesn't reflect the light of God anymore. There's so much smut and on it. So we have to polish the mirror of the heart by cleansing the heart. And the more the heart is cleansed, and the more we remove the veils of the heart or unlock the knots of the heart, then more the light of self shines through the heart. And we can experience the illumination of that to various levels, because there are different aspects to the bliss sheet. It itself has different orbits or spheres of influence. Okay, so I'm arguing then in these studies, I'm trying to explain these concepts of the human consciousness and self originating from the heart, and I contrast that with the scientific head doctrine. And this is a profoundly important issue. In all the discussions of science and religion, no one kind of realizes a bit that, hey, it's not, don't just argue the issues of science and religion on a philosophical basis. These teachings have different predictions about what the nature of consciousness is. Science proposes the head doctrine. Okay? Mystics argue the heart doctrine. So when we talk about science and religion, the most critical issue for us to look at scientifically is the issue of the nature of human consciousness. And in that area, we can see that there are very distinct viewpoints. Now, the fact that maybe consciousness is associated with the heart and blood, as I say, that doesn't necessarily prove the mystical or religious interpretation of that either. Like, you could maintain the materialistic viewpoint, and you don't necessarily have to limit consciousness to the head. Because within the body, there, all the neurons are not simply in the head. The heart has its own neurological system, which is not controlled by the brain in the head. In fact, the electromagnetic volume of the heart is 5,000 times the volume of the mind in the brain. So the heart is really the center of the human being as a quantum system. And that's what we are as living beings. We're quantum systems. Now, to understand my perspective, like, I'll refer to another Scientific American article they had on the cover. It had the question, are you a hologram? And it had a picture of a person's head and a kind of sphere around the person's head. Okay, now, see, that's how scientists now, if they think, is a human being a holograph, everyone thinks the hologram is produced around the head. And I would again argue that this is a fundamental mistake. To consider a human being as a particle of all that exists, or a microcosm of the macrocosm, We have to take a human being as a whole quantum system. And the center of that quantum system is the heart. So the hologram isn't just produced around the head, but around the whole living being, but centered on the heart. Blavatsky explains in terms of creation dynamics, she says the suns, meaning a living universe or a sun or a living human being, the suns expand and contract through their own selves and heart. So for Blavatsky's view, in what I try to explain is in the way consciousness emerges within without from zero points, when life comes into the body and it all spreads out through all the body from the heart center, what the Dalai Lama calls the indestructible drop. And when a person approaches death, then all these energies gather back towards the heart and pass into the deeper dimensions of the heart. And then the spirit soul leaves the body, even though it doesn't actually work like that. You don't leave the body falls away in a way because you continue to exist in these subtle bodies that you're already clothed in. So I'm trying to explain a model of how to try to understand multidimensional existence. And I'm saying it has to do with the mysteries of the heart and the idea of this divine spark or God spark or Jiva Atma or monadic essence in the higher dimensions of the heart. Before I finish, I want a related concept is of there being within the heart a vacated space. And to understand consciousness in a way, it's useful to understand it in a way as a form of no-thingness. Firstly, the idea within the heart is a vacated space. Now, here the idea is that God, as an infinite being, or the infinite life principle, in order to allow finite beings to come into existence, had to vacate a space where the infinite light was withdrawn from a volume of space so that the infinite didn't fill up everything. So he had to vacate a space, and that in Kabbalah is called the zimzum, the self-contraction. And then in Kabbalah, a line of light penetrates into that empty space, and that instigates the processes of creation. So I'm saying that a similar process occurs within the spaces, high-dimensional space of the human heart, that there's a light source, and it exists with it illuminates within this vacated space. Now, to understand the significance of this is very complex and subtle. But imagine looking around, and when I look around the room around me, and I see the walls and the light and books and magazines and so on, and I can see all these things, the clouds, trees, lights. I can see all these things. Now, all of these things exist within space. Now, can I see the space? In a way, no, I can't see the space. It has no color or smell or texture. Space itself is a kind of no thing, but it's because of there being space that allows for all the different things to exist within the nothingness of space. This is a subtle argument, but I'm arguing that human consciousness, in a way, similarly, is this nothingness. And because there's this nothingness, that allows us to be aware of all the things through our different bodies. Okay, so we can be a world of things in the material world or within the astral or mental worlds, but consciousness itself is like this no thing. If you imagine the human being as living in a matrix and all the forces and things around you in your life, but at the heart of the matrix there is this kind of nothingness. So if you could solve the matrix or the puzzle you're in and resolve all the broken symmetries and so on, then the person might disappear back to that zero point center. That in Kabbalah, that would be ascending the central column of the ladder of Jacob or the tree of life. As you balance the side Sephirah and bring the forces into alignment, it's like the essential self can pass up the central column of the tree of life. And as you do that, you can attain to higher levels of illumination and consciousness. The Kabbalistic model of the ladder of Jacob, of four trees of life overlapping and extending from each other, is a very absolutely remarkable model of the nature of higher dimensional space. And this concept, in a way, the ladder of Jacob is a model of the structure of the quantum vacuum. Okay, so these are some of the areas that the focus on. I usually like to begin the radio show with getting back to the heart doctrine, the zero point teaching, trying to understand some of the physics of this. Okay, so, Jim.
Yeah.
Are you there? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, any comments, any reflections on anything I've said?
Well, yeah, it was kind of brilliant and complicated at the same time. It's like, it was a nice statement of things. I'm not sure that, people hearing it for the first time would probably be lost and thinking certain points, but one thing that you mentioned singularities earlier, and you mentioned zero points, and maybe she could just amplify. Well, okay, I'll go back a second to say that, like, in this whole kind of alternative scheme that you're presenting, it's like a hierarchy because you're talking about different dimensions and different world orders of different levels of consciousness. And each of these worlds is discrete, and yet the higher influences the lower, and there's some sort of passage of influences from the higher to the lower. And the idea of the zero point is that these are like portals or some sort of transition points between the world orders. I think that's what you're saying. So maybe if you could just talk a little bit about zero points a bit more and singularities, I think would be helpful.
Okay. What I mean by zero point is it's like when you try to examine the nature of something, like an atom or a particle, a quanta. As you try to examine it closer and closer and closer, you come to a certain level where you can't measure something any further because of the uncertainty principle in quantum physics. That you can only specify the position and momentum of a particle to a certain depth of understanding, and then it, in a sense, disappears from view. It passes into the infinite. So as you narrow something to a point, it seems to pass into the infinite. So a zero point is like how the infinite tries to kind of narrow down its influence to a point, and then it wells up from within without through that point. The image of an hourglass is useful to imagine there being a spiritual realm above, and those spiritual forces come down to a point and then emerge and into the realms below. So I use the hourglass image as an image of a zero point. So in that view, then the zero point is really a portal. It's like you approach, you have your egg timer there, and you have approach from below, and you come to the portal, the zero point, which then opens up to the realm above. So I'm saying a human being similarly has this kind of hourglass structure within the higher dimensions of the heart, by which the infinite comes down to a point and then emerges from within without from a point with respect to the body below. So that's part of it, and I mean, it always struck me, when I think sometimes this idea that a human being has a singularity source, it's, it always struck me that what seems more inconceivable, that a universe with everything around us, the huge universe and the stars and people and all the matter and everything in the universe emerged from a singularity point, like that's pretty bizarre. And yet that is what modern scientists have arrived at. Okay, now you look at the material world, and if someone didn't have some background in science and you said it all emerged out of a point, you would think that person crazy. Like, how possibly could everything emerge out of a point? And yet that's what scientists have arrived at. In a way, things emerge from within without through zero points. Another analogy of it is, suppose we take a fertilized human ovum. A fertilized human ovum is barely perceptible to a naked eye. So a fertilized human ovum would appear as like a speck on a piece of paper, a dot. So in a way, you couldn't differentiate it. We'd just look at it as like the tiniest of dots. Okay, now, in a way, that is a zero point, like it's a point source. Now, if you go in and you say, okay, well, a fertilized ovum has a complex inner structure of all the DNA and the RNA and all the chemicals. So it has. So what appears on one level just to be a point, if you go into it, it's a whole world in itself, very complicated world. Okay. So similarly, what might appear as a zero point, it's like if you go into it, it might open up to a whole other world within on another order of scale or within other dimensions. So zero points, in a way, it's like they're portals. I mean, there's different ways in which the term is used, Jim. It's subtle and complex, kind of like how to...
But it's
very interesting...
It's definitely both of those. It's definitely both subtle and complex. I mean,
Yeah, subtle and complex.
I mean, because even in terms of like how a zero point relates to our traditional notions of space, it's quite complicated. It's not sort of like, you know, that the zero point is in space, but sort of the space is in the zero point.
Thank you. That's so good that you bring that up. Yeah, it's not that the zero point is in four-dimensional space-time. It's more that four-dimensional space-time world emerges out of the zero point. Yeah, so it's squeezed, a space-time complex is squeezed out of a point. So it expands, it grows out of a point, and eventually it contracts without within back to the point. But this process is what occurs in the inner man or inner individual. Like the body, when you die, the body goes back into the earth and it breaks down and the elements return to the earth. But I would say the inner individual moves through these higher dimensions and is subject to these zero-point dynamics. I mean, they're always there. The zero-point, see, I would say at the core of our being, I would depict the nature of self as a point source of light within hyperspace. And I would say that's a conjunction of the divine spark, the spiritual or father principle, and it exists within hyperspace, which is the divine mother. So it's a conjunction of the point source of light within hyperspace. That is that conjunction that produces human consciousness and being existence. It's not just the star, it's this star established in higher dimensional space.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, just listening when you were talking earlier, and you know, the analogies that people use, like if for the Jiva Atma, like it's an undifferentiated source of light about the size of a grape, you know, and then people are talking about at the first instance of creation, science, you know, liken it to this mass about the size of a grapefruit. And it's interesting, it's like the repetition of the idea of like a seed or an egg or fruit. You know, it's like the idea of something
yeah.
being so concentrated, but also somehow containing the intelligence to manifest itself through a process of differentiation and formation, so that eventually, you know, that acorn that's lying on the ground becomes an oak tree, or the mustard seed, you know, becomes a plant, whatever the analogy is. It's interesting how that kind of recurs. And as you say, is it really any more, it's not even a question, it's not really that much more, in any way, more fantastic to conceptualize that, you know, human beings are the product of a singularity as it is that the entire universe is the process or is the
yeah,
product
it's a neat analogy, eh?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
and again, it kind of goes to the whole idea that, you know, when people who are critical of mysticism from a scientific perspective say, well, you know, there's nothing really lucid or rational about it. It's precisely the opposite, because, you know, when people are critical of like religious ideas, they say, well, you know, they interpret them in a fundamentalist kind of way, and they don't see that things are allegorical or allude to other things. So when it says in the Bible that man is made in God's image, you know, I mean, that doesn't mean that God is some guy who looks like us, you know, like human
no.
beings. But when you're describing the dynamics of creation, like a space is vacated, you know, because there's this infinite sea of light and energy, and so which is God's radiance. So God has to contract to allow for this to manifest and crystallize as some sort of creation out of that basic field, eh? And then you describe describe exactly the same dynamics in terms of the creation of a human being as a conscious being. That's how, you know, you could interpret what the idea that, well, God is man is made in God's image. It's not like Gurdjieff
yeah.
says mockingly, it's not because we both carry our combs in our front pocket, you know. It's a little
yeah.
more complicated than that. And it's funny how, like, the more you kind of read and understand these parallels between mystical and esoteric teachings and the dynamics that are being uncovered by modern physics, you realize how utterly profound these ideas are that have existed. I mean, I don't know, how old are the Vedas? Like 4,000 years or something like that?
Yeah, I think 3 to 5. Yeah, three to five years.
Yeah, because they were written over. But I mean, the most striking, sophisticated analysis of consciousness in these ancient ideas. You know, or the description of the divine spark, it recurs throughout mystical and esoteric teachings, you know, and yet modern science has discovered in the 20th century that, you know, that there was a divine spark that created the world, you know, and yet these things have existed for thousands of years in these esoteric teachings. It really, if you're open-minded about it, you have to realize that, well, there's something very profound here that needs to be understood, but it can't sort of be understood all at once, and it can't be understood in our own terms. We have to study it extensively. I mean, how long have you been studying this? 30 years, you know? It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort to try to understand these things.
Yeah, and to know what all the words mean, kind of. Like, we can have the concept of these things, but in a way to begin to actually cultivate awareness of experiencing yourself
yeah.
in those ways. That's what we're trying to get to. But the
yeah.
ideas are so valuable as a, like a signpost, you know, like giving us a direction to try to cultivate awareness of ourselves. I
yeah.
was just going to quote this. This is a quote from Audie Daw.
Oh, yeah.
Who I would say is certainly someone, a remarkable kind of God-realized individual of some stature. He writes, "In this process of translation," he calls it, "we pass as if through a point in space at the root center of the heart. All awareness converges on that point in a kind of spiral or vortex. And that point is so small it is without dimensions or any conceptions or any objects. The independent self seems to dissolve in this narrow passage. The divine translation is a matter of transcendence of separate bodily, emotional, mental, supermental, and egoic states of experience. It is a translation to the infinitesimal space of the heart. See, that's the direct explanation. It's direct experience of what I'm trying to articulate here.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting that, as I say, that repeatedly you find these dynamics. I think one of the things that really struck me about in reading your book, in The Heart Doctrine, and you go through various teachings and show how repeatedly people talk about the I experience and consciousness being centered in the heart through all sorts of different traditions, to the point where I actually told you, you know, maybe you need to take some of these quotations out because there were so many of them that from so many different traditions, it's almost like overkill. And yet that idea has completely lost in modern thought, modern psychological thought, completely ignores it. And you have this creation of the head doctrine, which is essentially really just an imaginary idea, because there's really no evidence to suggest that consciousness is produced in the cerebral cortex, which is the governing assumption of all modern psychological thought about consciousness, that it's somehow produced in the head.
Or more interaction between the cortical and subcortical functions. But generally, basically, in the mind, in the brain, and involving the upper cortical functions,
And at consciousness, the corollary is that consciousness, it consists of the contents of awareness, and that the metaphor is generally of the stream of consciousness, and that's what consciousness is. It's generally the contents of awareness, especially the emphasis is on thought and thinking processes. As you say, cognitive psychologists strive to study the psychology of consciousness, and they end up equating thinking with consciousness.
William James used to like use those terms equivalent, the stream of consciousness or the stream of thought, which from a mystical perspective is a complete mistake. And in fact, the stream of thought is seen more as an obstacle to higher consciousness, because all the minding activity, well, it heightens the blood flow to the brain, and it centers our consciousness more in the mind, in the brain, but really to experience a deeper level of self, it's like we need to still the mind, because the self is like hidden behind, the mind is always so active, whereas the self, it's like, you know, it's like Gibran says, the mind longs to know the secrets of the heart, but it's like the heart exists in silence, and the mind is like chatter, 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 has all these conflicting and different aspects to itself. So it is so multifaceted, whereas the self kind of is there, but it's a voice of silence, Blavatsky calls it. It's like you have to still the mind to experience the voice of silence.
Yeah.
It's interesting, in Kabbalah, there are five levels to the soul, and they say the lowest level of the soul life is connected to the breath. And if you go into a deep state of self-sensing or relaxation, and you get to that point of feeling that stillness, like the peace that passeth all understanding, and feeling the breath in that state, and a very relaxed state, that's the lowest level of the soul life in the body. So to feel your soul life, you want to connect to that level and go into that state and be breathing in that soul life and in that place of peacefulness within yourself. So that's why I disagree with a lot of methods of meditation, which in my mind, they try to use the mind to control the mind or stop the mind, and it ends up the meditation mainly tends to be in the head. Whereas I suggest that in meditation we want to experience the whole of ourselves and be experiencing the breath within ourselves. Okay, so I got off a little bit, Jim. What were we were talking about? Oh yeah, the idea of the singularities and science. One thing that strikes me at times is, it's so funny, it's you know how they say, like, Columbus discovered America? It strikes me, oh, yeah, well, I mean, there were probably how many million people living in, like,
millions.
Natives living in America. Yeah. But it's like when Columbus comes, then America's discovered now, you know?
Yeah.
It's like someone arrives in your village and they say they've discovered it, like... And in a way, it's like scientists today, they've arrived at these concepts of singularities and of the vacuum as both void and plenum. And those are ancient mystical ideas in all the esoteric traditions, and now they're being confirmed by modern science. But now modern science thinks they've discovered it.
Well, and it's funny because...
I mean, they have.
Yeah, they have, but it's not, it's all relative. I mean, because it's like in the 1960s when the biofeedback processes started, movement started, and people in psychological laboratories started realizing that certain processes, autonomic processes, which were thought to be involuntary, could actually be regulated by voluntary control, and they used biofeedback machines to do that. And this was a great discovery in psychology. And of course, all over Asia, yogis were probably just jumping back into their bodies from the astral realm so that they could get themselves to the nearest laboratory to learn about this amazing discovery. I mean, you know, yogis have been doing, I mean, that's child's play compared to what yogis have been doing in terms of mastery of the physical body and the breath and consciousness for thousands of years, you know. I mean, it's completely comical. It's completely ridiculous. But at the same time, it kind of underlines the kind of the hubris of modern psychology and science, in the sense that, you know, when psychologists talk about consciousness and they're experts on consciousness, really most of these people, in fact I think, you know, almost all of them, have completely ignored something as simple as what you just said. They don't meditate. They've never been instructed in breath control. They've never, you know, pursued the dynamics of diet and fasting. I mean, these are of sacred movement. These are all
all the spiritual practices of developing
and not only developing and knowing consciousness, but developing and transforming it. These are all methods.
Yeah.
You know, these are all scientific in the generic sense of science. Scientific methods of studying consciousness and studying the transformation of consciousness. Like, modern psychology just wants to study consciousness and doesn't recognize the idea that it can be transformed. Like, it completely ignores the huge volume of evidence that suggests consciousness can be transformed. Psychologists completely ignore that, and they just want to study it as it is, or, as Uspensky says, as they suppose it to be, you know?
Meanwhile, man as
we suppose him to be. Yeah, meanwhile, you know, the ancient esoteric psychologies are all premised on the idea that people can consciously evolve and transform their consciousness, and that they can know themselves in dimensions beyond the material physical world, and they can know these higher being bodies that they possess, and they can know these higher realities. And yet this is all seen as some sort of vague and insubstantial misty thinking of mysticism, which is completely ludicrous. You know, I mean, it's just so completely stupid. It's unbelievable. I've been writing about this recently, so I'm getting kind of worked up about it. But the more I look,
yeah, the more you see it, the more you grasp the inanity of it.
Exactly. The inanity of modern psychological research and in a lot of ways, the pseudoscientific basis of it all. It's all just sort of groundless in the sense that it's got nothing to do with reality. That's my estimation now. You know, I'm almost embarrassed that I studied psychology, you know. Well, I'm glad I studied it. There's a lot to it, but it's all rooted in the wrong foundation. I mean, it all makes sense if you see it in the more comprehensive and realistic picture. There is something to it. It's not like, I shouldn't say that, you know, I shouldn't give the impression that I'm kind of denying it, but it's just that people within the discipline don't see how limited it is. I guess that's it. And also that, as I say, that there's this whole other history of psychology, which is thousands.
Jim? I've lost Jim there. I'm not sure if I'm on or Jim's on. I guess we both have to keep talking until, keep it going until we connect here again. Don, if you're in the background, are we having trouble here? So, okay, well, I'll pick it up in case I'm on air here and keep it going. So Jim was just talking about the mistakes made in the West and how we tried to approach this study of consciousness. And it's not so much that the facts of science are wrong. It's more that we have to reinterpret many things. That we have certain false interpretations of phenomena. Like in a recent article I read on where they're arguing the mind and the brain produces consciousness, and they have this picture showing some of the studies which show how they measure what part of the brain is active during different perceptual tasks. And what these brain scans show, they're actually measuring blood flow. So although they are saying that the brain is producing consciousness, their actual images of that they take to demonstrate the phenomena of consciousness is actually the measure of blood flow. Now, they don't think the blood flow has anything to do with it. They think that consciousness is due to the neural activity, whereas I would suggest that, no, consciousness is connected to the blood flow and the oxygenation process. And it's related to light. So some of these data showing how I have no problem with the data in science where you can see what parts of the cortex are active during different cognitive tasks. I have no problem accepting that. But just pointing out that blood flow can be through the whole body, or blood flow is through the whole body, and we can bring our attention anywhere within our body. And as we do that, the blood flows to that part of the body. Jim mentioned biofeedback a few minutes ago. And I remember being 20, 30 years ago when I was a professor.
Chris?
Oh, hello?
Did we lose your guest?
I can't understand.
Is your guest still online with you?
I've lost Jim, eh? Am I on air or is Jim on air?
We have you, but did we lose Jim?
Your voice has such a kind of distortion to it, the sound. I'm not hearing what you're saying.
Okay, bear with me.
Oh, there.
Yeah, okay. How's that? Is that better?
Okay, are we on air at the moment?
We are, but did we lose your guest?
Yeah, I lost Jim.
All right. I'll try to get him.
I was trying to carry it along. I didn't know who was on there.
Okay, when did you lose him? Just shortly?
About maybe 5 minutes ago, less.
All right. To the audience, we'll be right back. We're going to be getting him on the air. You're going to hear a little tune here.
Okay, and I'll keep going. I keep going?
Sure, I'll put him on the other line. Sure, I'll put him on the other line.
Okay. Jim.
It's going to take me a bit to get him on the other line, though. I don't have them yet.
So, to the listeners, so I was just talking about, I remember getting some autogenic equipment, or actually it was a thermometer, like a temperature skin gauge, and I could hook it up to my feet, and I could increase the skin temperature of my feet 10 to 15 degrees within about 10 to 15 seconds. By simply bringing my consciousness into my feet. So in a way, when I try to be conscious of my feet, that directs the blood flow to the feet, and that warms them up. Jim?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jim. You got cut off there.
Yeah, I know.
Hello? I didn't know what was happening. I tried to carry on a little bit. I was just explaining how... scientists try to demonstrate where consciousness is in the brain by actually monitoring blood flow.
Okay.
And I, in that article in Time on the mysteries of consciousness, they have all these scans of the brain scans showing what parts of the cortex are active during different cognitive tasks. And I was saying how I have no problem with that, but how they don't think the blood flow is a part of that consciousness. And then I was trying to make a broader point. I was talking about learning how to increase the skin temperature of my feet, how I could so easily kind of increase the skin temperature just by being conscious of my feet. So suggesting that the consciousness is connected to blood flow, but the blood flow isn't only to part of the cortex, but it's also elsewhere in the body.
Yeah.
Jim.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, and
I don't know if I've got you in clearly. Can you?
Yeah. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah, I can hear you. Okay.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Good. Yeah. Yeah. Because you know we talked about this before, but I mean everybody knows this in terms of blood flow. When you get sexually excited, blood flows to your sexual organs. When you have a full meal, blood flows to your stomach to help in the digestion of the meal. If you sleep on your arm. And wake up and you have tingling or lack of feeling in your arm, it's because you cut off the blood flow or constricted the blood flow. I mean, there's all sorts of examples. Everybody has them in everyday
life. Yeah, a lot of observations. Yeah, self-observations. Yeah.
Consciousness is your physical being is intimately related to blood flow, and that blood flow, that's one of the things that, that was thought to be not under conscious control, volitional control, is you can raise the temperature of your body by increasing the blood flow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. And there's no way in modern theories of consciousness, I don't believe, how they could address these kinds of observations. Like, how would you explain with the model of the cortex how you can bring your awareness into the hand and it increases blood flow there? Like, it's not part of the sensory motor strip.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, it's not a motoric response like that. Instead, it's as though we exist directly in the autonomic nervous system. I mean, the blood flow is more related to the autonomic nervous system as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, going back, so, I mean, the broader point is that it's interesting how modern psychology from, I can't began like late 1800s, right through into this century, has for the most part completely ignored the study of consciousness. I mean, it was like it was banned from psychology for 60, 70 years. And then when it came back in, everybody assumed it had to do just with the brain. And then everybody got into the left brain, right brain business, which, you know, everybody thought, oh, you're reasoning with one half of your brain and your emotions in the other, or you had all these dualities of human existence, and everybody put them up in the head, like in Ornstein's book, Psychology of Consciousness. So people in even psychology as a discipline is defined as the science of behavior and the mind in that simple, simplistic, dualistic way. I guess when you learn esoteric psychologies, I think very early on we could see the simplicity and fundamental errors of modern psychology. Would you agree, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, going back to your point about, it was essentially behaviorism, which got rid of the study of the idea of consciousness, just thought it was that it was an epiphenomena, that it wasn't anything real, and in part it was because psychology under John Watson, who started the behaviorist movement in the 1920s, wanted to make psychology a science and wanted to divorce psychology from its original meaning, which is psyche, study of the psyche, which is the soul. And so Watson wanted to make psychology scientific by restricting its study to that which was externally observable, and therefore said that no one, his comment was that no one has ever seen a soul in a test tube. Therefore, that was why he got rid of, why he wanted to get rid of the study of the soul. And essentially it was the same with consciousness itself. You know, nobody's ever seen consciousness, so it doesn't exist. It's not real, which is really very literal-minded and very simplistic thinking. And yet this was the science of psychology until well into the 1960s before anyone even dared to talk about consciousness again, you know, and really, I mean, I think most people who haven't studied psychology, you know, who might be reasonably well educated would be surprised by, you know, how bizarre its history really is in terms of its, like, it's such desperate attempt to become a science that it really abandoned what it was its real, you know, its most central concern, which is the nature of consciousness. It's like, the other thing was that the introspectionists, which was a group that studied the contents of awareness and consciousness in what, maybe the 1910s or the late 1890s, I'm not sure exactly when they were going, but they sort of made a stab at trying to study the contents of awareness and consciousness and didn't really sort of get anywhere, and then that sort of fell by the wayside, but really they were on to something, but they just didn't know how to go about it, in the sense that they tried to study themselves, they just didn't study themselves systematically, you know, which is what Gurdjieff, for instance, says. You can't just study yourself willy-nilly without any kind of system. You need a system to organize your observations and your understanding of your consciousness and yourself. Really, modern psychology has never embraced that idea that real study of consciousness begins with self-study. If they want to find it externally, like, you know, so they look at the brain because they can look at the brain, it's externally observable, but they never study it within themselves.
Yeah. And I mean, even the broader, I remember the broader point, Uspensky saying psychology itself has to begin with self-study.
Yeah.
And how that's never formed a part of Western psychological techniques. I mean, it's all externalized and observation of other people.
Yeah.
And then even within behaviorism itself, it turned out that they realized that consciousness has this kind of critical role, because somehow it was through the consciousness which could decondition a person. It's like increases in consciousness help a person overcome the conditioning. Like all the behaviorists want to condition everybody so much using the principles of aversive and other conditioning. Whereas it's consciousness, when people attain consciousness of contingencies, then they're often freed of those conditioning influences. So consciousness is like this dispeller of conditioning.
Oh, that's interesting. And then when consciousness started to creep back into psychology, it was essentially through cognitive psychology. Eh? So consciousness was essentially equated with thought. I mean, thought was seen to be the most important element of consciousness. And, you know, there was recognition that there were other aspects, but certainly the emphasis was on cognition. And then through cognitive behavioral therapies, then they started to realize, well, it's not just cognition, it's also emotions and affect. And so it became, you know, affective and cognitive behavioral techniques. So little by little, you know, psychologists kind of recognized that, you know, the idea that consciousness is just an epiphenomenon and it's not real is completely ridiculous and really doesn't provide a very good account of psychology. But it's sort of allow these elements in one by one, first cognition, then emotional processes, but it's still all sort of centered in the brain and then the idea that this is all going on in the brain. And there's no real kind of attempt to go beyond that assumptive framework.
Yeah, that's why I was so shocked by some of these New Age movies and writings in New Age, what I call New Think. It is how in, like, What the Bleep Do We Know and Down the Rabbit Hole, they make the same mistake of assuming that consciousness is only produced in the mind, in the brain, and even talking only of emotions as involving the mind and brain, as well as peptides and neuropeptides. But again, they lack any appreciation that of the heart as related to a person's psychological makeup. I was shocked in those New Age movies. I thought they were really very significantly off base.
Yeah, and I completely agree, and it's like I think in part it's because when you look back on it, you know, like I think part of it is just the influence of the whole split brain phenomenon and how widely spread that idea that you know, in one hemisphere we have all these attributes, the rational and the intellectual, and the other side we have all of its opposites, and really it you know, that became such a pervasive idea in popular culture that I think it reinforced the whole idea that our consciousness is in our brain. So I think when people are trying to present these New Age type of ideas, they tend to fall into the trap of thinking, well, in order to legitimize things, we'll talk about it in terms of, you know, conventional scientific thinking and psychological thinking. But if they really...
Yeah, good point.
If they really...
Yeah.
If they really read the mystical sources, it's all there. It's like I was stunned when I started reading your book on the heart doctrine as to how frequently this appears, and yet the idea that, you know, that the heart is the center of consciousness and of the illuminating source within the heart. I mean, it's repeated over and over again, and yet people completely miss it. It's really actually quite bizarre, eh?
Yeah, people don't realize the significance of it. Like, they think, oh, it's just religious text or mystical teachings. They don't think that it's like a possible scientific basis to it.
Yeah, that it's metaphorical or, you know, poetic
or
something. But
people in their own religions don't realize the significance of those concepts, how profoundly important that is.
Yeah, and I absolutely, and I think that's... I think that's one of the very, exciting and promising aspects of your work is how you integrate these ideas and try to show that both science and religion are really lacking in terms of their understanding of these ideas about consciousness and how this whole alternative model of consciousness really casts everything in both science and religion in very different terms. I mean, it's quite profound and...
And then it's funny because people who, the scientists or people who consider themselves to be the scientists, they would dismiss all these evidences for paranormal phenomena, which suggests that consciousness is not simply neurological activity in the brain. So in a way, the scientist reminds me of what Uspensky, how he described them as closing their eyes to all the system-destroying facts. And Uspensky said, if we could collect together all the system-destroying facts in modern times, it would wash away everything we think we knew. And I think that's true in psychology today. And it's not that things in psychology, the ideas and theories, they all have applications and aspects of value to them, but the fundamental mistakes are so basic it propagates a series of misconceptions about the nature of emotions, nature of self, nature of consciousness, what we are as beings. I mean, people think it's scientific to think that we're simply material beings, but that's never established scientifically.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of contradictory evidence.
Yeah.
I mean, the evidence is, that's what I get from reading Dean Radin's book.
Yeah.
And there's all these evidences in all these different areas, but which have been done by competent scientists trying to, you know, apply the scientific method that often to the highest levels of scientific rigor. I mean, the paranormal researchers have to be almost more rigorous than regular scientists.
Yeah.
So, but it's like all these people have investigated these things and kind of reached their conclusions that there's evidences for all these phenomena, but the mainstream of science just kind of closes its eyes and humdrums along and says the cerebral cortex is where consciousness is manufactured. And it's just so superficial.
Yeah,
I can see the basis for a new science, for a new millennium, if we can begin to understand these higher dimensional aspects to ourselves.
Yeah, I guess the bottom line, like the fundamental. I totally agree with what you said about all these anomalies and enigmas, which really exist beyond the limits of the explanatory power of contemporary science. And I guess the bottom line is that the most fundamental phenomena, which I think really challenges our understanding of everything, is the idea that somehow consciousness can exist apart from the body, that what you were describing earlier when people have out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences, and somehow they're outside of their bodies and they're able to have like a third-person perspective on their own physical bodies or events occurring around the physical bodies. You read about this frequently in near-death experiences where people can see doctors laboring over them and they can successfully recount things later. And, skeptics say, it's anoxia, lack of oxygen, and they all have all these kind of pat explanations, but they really can't explain the phenomena of how people can have this exterior perspective because they can't allow that evidence in because if it's true, it violates all their fundamental assumptions about the nature of consciousness. And yet, I'd say that there's literally hundreds of thousands of experiences which add up to a violation of that basic assumption of modern Western psychology. In my own case, long before I had any invested interest in this, I had an experience when I was 12 years old. I was playing football, and I got tackled, and I hit my head on the ground, and suddenly I was outside of my body. And I could see my head coming off the ground. And I remember like it was yesterday because it was so vivid. It was kind of like a multiple exposure photograph where I could kind of see my head coming up off the ground, but multiple images of it. And I could see it. Now, to me, like the most, if you ask a scientist to explain that, they'll sort of jump through hoops to try to avoid the fundamental fact. Like, I hit my head. Why didn't I see the Mona Lisa? Or why didn't I see the Empire State Building? Why was I outside of my body seeing my body? Because I was outside of my body seeing my body, That's the most parsimonious explanation of that phenomena. And, if it just happened to me, that would be one thing. But as I say, there are hundreds of thousands of examples of people describing having been outside their body and seeing it. I saw Bob Woodruff recently on David Letterman. Bob Woodruff was the anchorman for ABC Nightly News who went to Iraq last year and was very severely wounded and almost died as a result of his wounds. And he was outside of his body, watching them work on him. And he had that experience, and David Letterman asked him, well, what do you think that was? And he said, I don't know, but he said obviously I wasn't dead, but I did have that third person perspective. And then apparently I'd like to read more about him because he had massive brain damage, and yet he's recovered within the space of less than a year. He's recovered his power of speech and his cognition is quite, I don't think it's fully recovered. But
Woodruff, this
yeah, is? Yeah, and I mean, oh. I think his case is quite baffling to doctors because I don't think he should be as lucid and in charge of his faculties as it is, given what's happened to his brain. So very interesting case. But as I say, everybody knows somebody. Start talking to anybody if they've had an experience in which they've been outside of their bodies. And it's like that's one example amongst many which really challenged the whole material reductionist materialist approach to science. Like it's very useful in predicting all sorts of things, but it's so limited in the sense that there's so much outside of that. Ironically, 20th century physics, you know, in trying to find the essential building block, the lowest common denominator of matter, has basically ended up with the idea that there isn't anything, that there's information, you know. So, I mean, it's really, physics is kind of confirmed sort of the limits of the materialist perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, physics doesn't have a materialist perspective. It's like psychologists have a false understanding of physics, really, to think that it supports just a simplistic kind of physical conception.
And that's the irony kind of, you know, that psychology was so busy trying to get rid of mind, and physics was, you know, coming up against, you know, ineluctable evidence that mind exists, like Sir Arthur Eddington said that the stuff of the universe is mind stuff, and Sir James Jean said that the more we study the universe, the more it resembles a great thought rather than a machine. And that was in the 20s and 30s, and I mean, I think the last 75 years has just really kind of led more and more, as you talked about John Wheeler, you know, that the idea that there's some sort of, if we're going to talk about the essential constituents of the universe, we have to talk about matter, energy, and mind, or intelligence,
yeah,
you know, on some level.
Yeah, or information.
Information.
Yeah.
You can't get away from it, you know.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's completely consistent with the teaching of the three gunas, which are thousands of years old, about matter, energy, and intelligence. Eh? So.
Yeah, and the whole mystical concept that creation is a manifestation of patterns within divine mind.
Yeah,
that there are spiritual and divine intelligences, and their intelligences and actually underlies what manifests in life.
Yeah,
so that space is permeated by these spiritual intelligences and influences. Just to go back for a second, and then I want to switch the topic a little bit, but just in regards to the skeptics, I did want to make the point. I always think it's funny how the skeptics, they always have their, oh, it's only lack of oxygen to the brain, okay? But what always amazes me about these skeptics who consider themselves these big scientists, and they think, because they can come up with an alternative hypothesis that an out-of-body experience is really due to deprivation of oxygen to the brain, they think because they can come up with the possible and the explanation, they assume that is the explanation. Like, they say, well, it's just due to the lack of oxygen to the brain. But do they ever demonstrate how in any particular case that caused it and how it... No, they don't. They think it's to answer it, just to provide an alternative hypothesis, but they provide no scientific evidence in support of their hypothesis.
Yeah,
you see what I'm getting at?
Oh, absolutely. And reading about the near-death experience, I mean, I've read some of the people who have studied this, and they're absolutely convinced that it's not, you know, a matter of an oxy, and that they're really none of the skeptical. None of the skeptical explanations that, you know, really pass muster. But as you say, like, yeah, they just seem to think. But really, that's all built into their assumptive framework. And they always say it's nothing but. And then they say, I don't see any way for this to occur. And see, that's where they say it's Occam's razor, you know, that the most parsimonious explanation is the best explanation. But they're judging what's the most parsimonious explanation in terms of their assumptive framework about the nature of reality. And that's where the mystical and esoteric perspective, in which we live in a universe, a multidimensional universe that consists of various levels of intelligence interacting with one another, provides a perspective where there is a possible way to explain these things. And that's what
there are models of it.
Yeah, completely, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, there are models of it. They've been in the mystical literature for thousands of years, like in different terminologies and you know, traditions and such.
Yeah, and as I say, like, I mean, again, too, it's like, you know, when people describe being out of their bodies and seeing their bodies. Well, why would, if they're out of their bodies, you know, if they have these experiences, why if you were deprived of oxygen, for example, why would you see that? Why wouldn't you see, you know, the Grand Canyon or the Great Wall of China or, you know, George Bush's face? I mean, why would you, the most parsimonious explanation is the reason why you saw your body is because you did see your body. I mean, you know, but it's just so ridiculous to try to frame it in those terms. It's like, oh, well, you know, it's nothing but this. Well, no, I think you're missing the point, you know.
Also, you know, another interesting point is if that hypothesis of theirs is right, well, then there should be a lot of people having near-death experiences who have suffered brain damage afterwards.
Yeah.
So those people who come back who have had they should show evidence of brain damage, but there's never been any evidence to demonstrate that.
And then in conjunction with that, I mean, you know, you have this explanation of the common explanation of the people, you know, seeing the tunnel of light, right? And this is, you know, is many, many people have reported this. Now, from a scientific perspective, when you have consistency of reports, generally you assume that people are, you know, probably observing something that exists. But, like, let's just suspend that for a second, and look at it from some other perspectives. I mean, repeatedly, the idea of light occurs in all sorts of explanations of mystical mystical experiences, you know, both of those that are cultivated by people who are intentionally trying to develop their consciousness and those that happen to people spontaneously. Like, people have visions of light. People are illuminated.
Yeah, experiences of,
I mean, this occurs over and over and over again. Like, Aldous Huxley wrote a wonderful essay about light and the mystical experiences and he said, you know, there's two essential categories that in his reading of these experiences that happens, and one is where light is kind of, people have an experience where everything is kind of shining and is effulgent. You know, it's like the light quality of the physical world is enhanced in their awareness. And I've had that experience on psychedelic drugs.
Yeah, me
you know?
Too.
Then the other side of it is where people actually feel illuminated, where they have they're flooded with this supernal light, like they have this spontaneous, you know, well, in many cases, spontaneous experience, and the light, somehow, when they experience the light, they have a feeling of the essential, quote-unquote, all-rightness of the universe, and people very frequently report after this that they lose their fear of death. You know, now this is not people who have been trying to develop their consciousness through practicing some sort of discipline. This is just spontaneous experiences. I would say, you know, we should try to understand more about that light, because, you know, somebody could come up with a therapeutic technique which would tell people about the essential all-rightness of the universe and that they would stop losing their fear of death. I'd say they'd be pretty freaking
successful.
Yeah,
if you could simulate the effect of that experience somehow so that people had a similar...
Yeah, I would say that's an incredibly profound thing. But then again, if we go back to the tunnel of light that people experience in the near-death experience, I don't think it's accidental that people keep experiencing the light when somehow they lose their body or they exist in some state of non-consensual state of consciousness that, you know, some higher elevated state of consciousness that departs from the normal waking consciousness. They keep experiencing the light. Well, why is that?
Yeah.
It's probably because there's something to the light, you know what I mean? And given the fact that mystics and esoteric mystics have described this for thousands of years, I mean, I know there's something to the light, you know? That's where it's so silly to just kind of try to cram everything into our very limited understanding of things as they are in the so-called normal world, you know? It's quite ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, you see how... In modern psychology, I don't know of any psychologist who considers consciousness to be light. Like, the idea is, like, in the kind of new quantum physics of consciousness, this fellow thinks it's microtubules structures or something in the brain. But people don't consider that there might be an inner light source, and that consciousness indeed is this kind of light or pure light. Or
yeah.
Like the Dalai Lama, he explains that our human individual consciousness, he says, is a reflection of the mind of clear light. So consciousness is like that clear light, clear knowing. And we find that all through the mystical traditions, even though it's worded slightly differently and so on. Yeah, it's one of the clues as to the nature of consciousness, which has been like most ignored and not considered in modern times. Consciousness as light.
Yeah. I mean, you know, another... I was just going to say another angle sort of on this whole topic is just referring to something we were talking about earlier about, you know, how it takes time to understand these ideas. I mean, think back to when we were first starting to study the fourth way, and there is a quote that consciousness is light, and it sort of was, my understanding was that sort of like consciousness is light in the metaphorical sense that, our normal psychological functions operate in the dark, but if we can be more conscious, we'll have more light, so we'll be able to operate more efficiently and more consciously. But then, you know, I started to realize, well, it's not just a metaphorical description that, you know, that maybe that this is something that has to be understood literally. And I mean, now, you know, 30
yeah.
years later, I mean, we both got interested in the holographic model of consciousness, and I mean, you know, that led you to David Bohm's work, and then to start, and Carl Priebram, but beyond that, and then trying to think of it in terms of like how consciousness is the reference beam that illuminates the psychic functions, and then that led to the idea of like the divine spark in the heart, you know, and then the idea of
yeah.
you know, the source in the higher dimensions of an undifferentiated mass of light. I mean, it's so much more complicated, eh? Like, I mean,
it involves
a process of reworking and kind of leading to more and more comprehensive understanding of how something like, okay, consciousness is light. That's a very simple statement, but what does that mean?
Yeah.
Well, it means it can
yeah.
be interpreted on a whole variety of different levels, you know?
Yeah. I think it's very useful to think that of the consciousness as light is somehow separate from the material basis of creation. Like,
yeah.
it's like, you know, everything in material realm in a way creates a matrix or a web.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like consciousness is that light that can illuminate what that matrix or a web is. But the consciousness is something other than the web or the matrix. It's
mm-hmm.
that which illuminates
mm-hmm.
the matrix, aspects of the matrix.
Yeah.
We've just got to 10-15 minutes left. I thought maybe I'd just switch the world, share a few things that ongoing kind of socio-political things. I didn't know, did you happen to hear about this BBS, the British Broadcasting Corporation, BBC material they released this last week about 9/11? Did you hear about that?
I heard some reference.
What they did was they released original footage from the day, and it's so funny, you wouldn't believe this.
No.
They're explaining, one of the announcers explaining, Building 7 has come down, and they cut away and they have different interviews, and then they go back live to New York to this female announcer who's talking about the collapse of Building 7. But the whole time she's talking, Building 7 is visible behind her, and it's not collapsed. You see, they had done it before the building came down.
What?
And she's talking away that Building 7 has come down, but behind her, you see Building 7 is still there. You get what I'm saying?
Well, but you mean the BBC knew that Building 7 was coming down?
Yeah, they had done this news clip before it even happened, but when they had done it ahead of time, the building was there, and they didn't think that, oh, yeah, once we say that, the building shouldn't be there. This came out. It was on Prison Planet, www.prisonplanet.com.
What's the explanation
and,
for that?
Well, they don't offer one. It was funny because it was in the week following when the BBC released this kind of this half-hour documentary, kind of poo-poo the conspiracy theory stuff. And then the next week, this comes out, and it was up on the internet. I saw it, and it was put up. Alex Jones, A Prison Planet. I listen to that show sometimes. He was trying to. He was trying to load it down off the internet, and then it kept being taken off, but then people all downloaded it and reloading it, and it was a funny thing, like the internet war is trying to get this video out of this. It's quite shocking.
Wow.
You know, but I mean, no one has to answer for anything, so I mean, you know, it's neat. It's more proof kind of for something pretty devious there, but it's like nothing makes any difference anyway because there's so much proof already. But it was really quite funny.
Wow.
I just wondered if you'd... Yeah, it was shocking. You can go on there.
I've been to that site, actually, but that's really peculiar. I don't
that, know. That was one peculiar thing. Here's a couple other things. I also go to www.informationclearinghouse.com, which is an excellent source of kind of in alternative information and essays on the whole kind of wars and political things and very educational site where you get a lot of the information we don't in the mainstream media. Anyway, I saw a most interesting clip up there today, a video of this American man who's deserted the army, and he's come to Canada, like after the Vietnam War, eh, Jim?
Yeah.
And he's seeking political asylum in Canada.
Yeah, I've seen
and
that.
Actually, there's supposed to be 26 people seeking political asylum in Canada, like who've left the forces.
Yeah.
And he was in this interview. He talks about how he kind of realized when he was over there that they were the terrorists, that he realized that they were terrorizing people, you know, and how, you know, he went there, like, you know, because he wanted to defend America and that, and then, but then he kind of, like, began to see it in such a different way. He couldn't morally continue with it anymore, so he's seeking asylum in Canada. And I was just thinking, oh, there may be more instances of that. So that was another interesting thing came up. And oh, yeah, another interesting thing I saw. These are a few news items from my weeks. It was very peculiar. I was watching CNN the other day, and they were just talking about Obama and showing video of Obama being, I think it was at a rally in Texas. And I was shocked because when they were showing Obama, like, out on the stage and kind of meeting people, someone there had a big Investigate 9/11 sign that was clearly prominent in this whole two-minute clip of Obama kind of going around and greeting people and being cheered. And there was this big Investigate 9/11 That was funny because I was shocked. I thought, why would CNN show that, you know? I was puzzled by that.
Yeah. Well,
so that was...
Nothing happens. That's why they show it, you know? Like, I mean, you know, nothing really changes. Like, at this point, I don't even think that, you know, anybody's terribly worried about it. You know?
No, it's kind of, yeah.
It's out there.
It's an odd situation.
Yeah, it's out there, but it's just exactly like the Kennedy assassination, you know. People didn't really believe,
yeah,
you know, that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy, but, you know, nothing happened, you know. I mean,
it doesn't, eh?
It went
it's
on
so
for,
disgraceful. It's so
it was
disgraceful.
15 years before the House Assassinations Committee finally was convened, you know, after the fact, and 15 years of dead people and evidence missing and, you know, trails going cold. And even then, when they started to do some real important and good investigative work, the lead investigator, who really was doing a fantastic job, got fired. And, you know, investigation was taken over and steered towards the mafia. And, you know, even though they ended up saying that there was probably a conspiracy to kill Kennedy, that's where it sort of stopped, you know, but it never went anywhere near where it really had to go. And that's 9/11. There should be an international commission, you know, that forget, you know,
forget the American government. They're completely hopeless. You know, they're not going to do anything about it. And it should be.
It's discouraging. I thought the Democrats might do a little bit more to try to rein in the president, but
they have absolutely no interest in it. Give me a break. You know, do you think Hillary Clinton wants to stir that up? I mean, come on.
No.
Or Obama or John Edwards. I mean, none of these idiots.
No one wants.
None of these.
There is one candidate, Jim.
Oh, is that right?
There's one Republican candidate, Ron Paul, who's being recommended by Alex Jones. And
okay.
I mean, I don't know how if he focuses on 9/11, but I think has a broader, deeper kind of understanding of the kind of corruption of how the system has become so corrupted. Ron Paul's an interesting alternative, I think, for people within the Republican Party.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah, he doesn't get any coverage on the main media.
Gee, I wonder why.
But he is up there. Yeah, I wonder why. Yeah, I think his stress more is on kind of reining in the corporate elite a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that's an aspect a bit more of his program and lobbying in Washington and such. Things that have undermined the real democratic basis of the country, you know?
Yeah, well, if he gets anywhere, he'll probably end up killing himself.
Yeah. I'm having an accident or something. Discouraging.
There's another. She's a Democrat member of Congress. I believe she's still a member of Congress. Cynthia McKinney, who's she's participated in the 9/11 Citizens Commission, and she's been. She's a multiple term congresswoman from. I'm not sure where she's from. From the south somewhere, and she's one of the few people in Congress who's really tried to look at this and has tried to do anything about it, but they're few and far between, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's sad, you know, because in all of these, like government and police and FBI, CIA, and all of these services, like I really believe the majorities of people are well-intentioned and good-hearted kind of, like, but in a way the whole thing is so corrupted and they're just, everybody's powerless in a way.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know?
I agree.
One other thing. Oh, this was an interesting thing, too. Again, from Alex Jones, kind of. He has such good interviews on there. Couple things. One, this pilot quit from, I think it was Boeing. And apparently Boeing is now putting charges in airplanes so that they can blow them up in the air.
Oh.
It's like, I guess the rationale is if a terrorist sees an airplane is going to try to fly somewhere, they can blow it up, kind of.
Yeah.
But it also means that, you know, that someone there might be a complete computer glitch or something, the main explosives are on the doors, so they can blow the doors off.
Well, that's great. I mean, there's already altered.
He was also talking, this pilot who kind of quit Boeing and is bringing this out, and he's got a multi-million-dollar suit against him or something.
Wow.
And he was also saying they're putting in all these gyroscopic mechanisms which can fly the plane, and so someone on the ground can take over the control of the flight of the plane. It's so funny because a lot of these inventions and possibilities could be valuable, but it's like when there's such kind of corruption and kind of seediness behind the scenes, it's horrifying, really, to, you know, what they're kind of setting up as the possibilities.
You know, our friend Tony, he always maintains, and I don't know enough about this, but he maintains that invention's already existed for years about being able to fly the planes from the ground.
Oh, yeah, well, in Prison Planet this year, from the ground, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, some people say that was what was done with 9/11.
Uh-huh.
And some people, also, it was an interesting story. Apparently, the debris field of the plane that went down, was it in Pennsylvania or West Virginia?
Yeah, Pennsylvania.
Anyway, the debris field was so wide, it was 8 miles.
Wow.
So normally a debris field, you know, might be like a kilometer or so.
A bomb
so now what they've kind of deducted different people investigating this is that it's most likely that airplane was just simply detonated in the air, and that's why you didn't find any substantial chunks of that plane. And that kind of makes sense now.
We're going to go off the air. We're going to go off the air very soon. John said.
Okay, yeah, we're 5-2. So anyway, so those are just a few political notes, and you know, I keep listening to Prison Planet and do encourage people to. I'm still concerned about, I think over in Iran, I think we're going to end up shoot first, ask questions later. I still have the kind of premonition or something that we're going to have a major conflict over there within the next weeks or month. Alex Jones actually predicts March 21st as the date that he kind of, his feeling about it.
Wow.
So I still see that as really a very critical kind of situation, and really quite worried about what might happen. We're certainly in an amazing world at the moment. Boy, the story unfolding on the world stage is beyond anything conceived in Hollywood. It's a real holy world tale. That's how I see it. Like this, you know, beyond any Hollywood scheme, like any Hollywood movie, pales in comparison to what's the tale of psychopaths and intrigue unfolding on the world stage. It's nothing like it. It's really quite remarkable. So it's a scary time, and it's like what Gurdjieff says, it's a good time to work on yourself. When he was in Uspensky before the war, and they felt the war looming, and Gurdjieff emphasized, yeah, this is a good time to be working on yourself.
Yeah.
And I'll try to remember yourself, stay strong, don't lose heart. Okay, Jim. Okay, so, we probably only have a minute here. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts on...
Remember yourself always and everywhere. I think exactly what you just said, you know, no matter how weird it gets out there, you know, you have to try to remember that this is the sleeping world we live in, and the only important thing is to wake up.
Yeah. The need to wake up. Yeah, we need to wake up. Yeah, humankind do. Sometimes I see things on the news. Sometimes I think, oh, things are shifting a bit, you know, and it's intriguing. Quite an adventure story.
Yeah.
Okay. So how are we doing here for time? We're almost on 6. So I would encourage people, I have lots of writings up on www.zeropoint.ca. I would most recommend my Heart Doctrine book. I think it's a very valuable contribution to modern and spiritual studies of human consciousness, trying to look at mystical teachings but cast them in a scientific perspective as a serious model of human existence. And that's just part of the Within Without from Zero Point series, dealing with these concepts of zero points and higher dimensions and so on. I'd like to thank James Moffat again for being here today, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. And until then, remember yourself always and everywhere. Thank you.
Thanks, Chip.